This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with attorney and author Chase Madar about his book on Bradley Manning.
The book, The Passion of Bradley Manning, examines both the political implications of what Bradley Manning allegedly did, as well as giving us a glimpse into who Bradley Manning is.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, I know in your capacity as the Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild, you once again are being called on to deal with the major protests we expect both in Tampa for the Republican National Convention and in Charlotte, North Carolina for the Democratic National Convention. Now, so far, I think what your experience has been at other demonstrations in Florida and in North Carolina, it doesn't necessarily bode well for the protesters. Can you give us a sense of what you expect both in Tampa and in North Carolina? And of course, both, just to remind our listeners, the Republican convention is at the last week in August.
The Democratic convention is the first week of September.
So Heidi, give us a little overview.
I think it's instructive to look at both the locations of the Republican and Democratic conventions. The RNC is going to be in Tampa, Florida. Now, listeners will recall, this is the state that spawned the so-called Miami model of policing at the FTAA demonstrations in 2003. And those were brutal police responses. Then we have Charlotte, North Carolina, which is essentially the banking capital of the South. If we look at the treatment of occupiers in both locations, it gives an indication of how convention protesters are going to be treated. And I think we're in for a messy 2 weeks in terms of protecting the right to dissent. In Occupy Tampa, for example, one person was held in custody for 20 days, Michael, just for staying in a park after a curfew. And local authorities threatened others who might do so with 45-day sentences. In Charlotte, they recently tested an event ordinance at a Bank of America shareholder meeting and on May Day. And I want to talk about these special event ordinances because I think these have the capacity to do lasting damage to the right to dissent.
I'd like to ask you about special event ordinances because normally we have a First Amendment out there and then we have the regular city ordinances around, you know, whether you need a permit for a parade, what times it can happen, etc. And as soon as I hear special event ordinances, it makes me nervous because it sounds like they're tailoring ordinances so that they can suppress protest because they're made up for the particular facts in the case. And I'm interested in whether that's happening in Tampa and is it happening in Charlotte?
Well, let me first start by answering that question. I mentioned the Miami model, and one of the components of the so-called Miami model is indeed the creating of special ordinances before a large protest event. And in many cases, these ordinances have been challenged in court and later found to be unconstitutional. Of course, as in many police-related actions and actions taken by local municipalities, the damage, in effect, is done because it has the effect of stifling free speech at a demonstration. Then it's challenged in court, found to be unconstitutional, but it kept people off the streets. And so that we're wary of ordinances passed in advance of a particular event. And I think what's insidious about these ordinances, we recently saw at the NATO summit in Chicago that Rahm Emanuel managed to propose a special event ordinance and then have its legacy live on for future events. So what happens is it creates what's called a special event designation. And along with that, usually we see the creation of so-called free speech zones or areas where protesters are restricted to, usually out of the eyes of the media and certainly out of the eyes of the convention delegates. But I think what's happening in Tampa and Charlotte is the city council members think these are just ordinances for the RNC and DNC. Setting aside the fact that that's likely unconstitutional, it looks as though these ordinances are being crafted in a way that will allow them to be invoked at future special events. It's also noteworthy that city council members in Charlotte have apparently asked for an explanation of what $50 million budget is being spent on around the DNC, but haven't been told that. So there's a cloud of secrecy about that, and certainly confusion about the enactment of these special ordinances. Again, a component to the Miami model, which also includes use of less lethal weapons, coordination with national, local, Secret Service, other arms of government, including the private sector. And we're seeing a lot of corporate involvement in these events in terms of surveillance, collecting data, spying on people, and the vilification of protesters in the media before.
So Heidi, you've given us quite a good description of both Florida and North Carolina, the RNC and the DNC, the end of August and then in September. But there's also a history with these political conventions. We had one here in New York. It was the RNC in 2004. Then you had one in Minneapolis, I think. You'll remember the year better than I. And then, of course, before that, you had the whole set of the WTO demonstrations in 1998 in Seattle. And I think that's where you began to see cops and the feds decide, we're not going to let big demonstrations happen again. And then, of course, you referred to the Miami model, which had federal, state, et cetera. But why don't you talk a little bit about what's happened at the conventions, and then let people know, if they plan to go, where they can go for more information on the Guild website and what they can do.
One of the things we've seen consistently at these events, and I think you're right, Michael, that a lot of police hype happened after the 1999 World Trade Organization protests in Seattle. There was a lot of misinformation about the nature of disruption of protests, blaming it on protesters when, in fact, we found a lot of agent provocateur. And the city of Seattle itself came out with an after report admitting that the police department did a very poor job of handling those protests. And we also had after reports from the FTAA demonstrations saying the police erred, they overreacted, they used violence when they didn't need to. Unfortunately, what has persisted in terms of the police narrative is that violent anarchists descend on a city or a town and they create havoc. Shop owners become embroiled in sort of the pre-drama and fear, as does the general public and the mainstream media coverage of it. And what we've also seen recently, starting with 2008 in the Twin Cities with the RNC, is a lot of arrests with the first use of state anti-terrorism legislation, going in and raiding organizers' spaces, finding ordinary household things like bleach, rags, ascribing evil intent to them, and then arresting individuals on terrorism charges that ties them up in the systems for years, sometimes results in really, I think, biased media coverage and jury trials. Sometimes the charges are dropped, but sometimes they're not. And so protesters are increasingly facing strict anti-terrorism legislation that really goes after, in many cases, lawful First Amendment-protected activities. We hope this doesn't discourage people from attending the protests if they want to do so, and we will be having hotlines and legal offices at the National Lawyers Guild in both locations. The hotline numbers will be posted, hopefully, in a few days and will be available at nlg.org. And people can call me directly if they'd like. My number's on the website, or email me at director@nlg.org, and we'll answer your concerns.
So thank you, Heidi. Again, it's director@nlg.org. Heidi will again be in the thick of things. If you recall what happened in New York when they arrested hundreds of people and kept them for days, or what happened in Minneapolis, as Heidi said, it stresses the importance of knowing your rights, of getting out there at the demonstrations, and of emailing Heidi and going to the Guild website. There's also available on the Guild website or by mail from the National Lawyers Guild. What is it, Heidi?
You Have the Right to Remain Silent, a little booklet that we'll be happy to send you free of charge.
So thank you, Heidi, and we'll see you next in Tampa.
Michael, we've been following the WikiLeaks and Julian Assange cases. What's happening most recently?
Here are some recent statistics on Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, and Bradley Manning. As of last week, WikiLeaks has been financially blockaded without process for 611 days. That's almost 2 years without any legal merit. PayPal, MasterCard, and Visa cut off the funds for WikiLeaks. As of last week, Julian Assange has been detained without any charges for 608 days. Again, almost 2 years. Of course, now he's in the Ecuadorian embassy, but he still remains in London, where he was kept detained for almost 2 years pending his extradition or possible extradition to Sweden, and then most likely on to the United States. 608 days as of last week. He has spent 46 of those days at the Ecuadorian embassy, where he remains. Bradley Manning, in an incredible statistic, has been imprisoned without trial for 805 days as of last week. And the secret grand jury that has been investigating a conspiracy to commit espionage with Julian Assange as its target has been continuing for 691 days. So we have this broad-ranging, punitive actions by the U.S. government, blocking WikiLeaks money, imprisoning Bradley Manning, making sure Julian Assange is detained, and then a grand jury that's just waiting to indict him, if they haven't indicted him already, and certainly extradite him from whatever country they can get their hands on him. That's the raw statistics. Here's what's actually going on as well. Bradley Manning's pre-trial hearings on the evidence discovery, motions to dismiss, etc., continue at Fort Meade in Maryland on a monthly basis. The court, if you want to dignify it with that word, the court sits 3 or 4 days a month and goes mostly in secret, in the sense that you can't get a hold of any of the public filings, even though they're, quote, public. The judge moves through the evidence quickly. It's hard to understand without getting a hold of the papers first. That's continuing, that trial. The next hearings, and I want to encourage people to go, are August 26th through August 31st. Again, they're going to be on various motions filed in the case with regarding getting a hold of evidence about Bradley Manning. So again, there's always demonstrations in front of Fort Meade. It's not the easiest place to get there. You can go by train, you can get there by car. But I encourage people to get out and support Bradley Manning. His trial now probably won't happen until January or February. In October of this year, there's going to be an important hearing on the lawyer for Bradley Manning's motion or argument to dismiss the entire case based on the pretrial torture of Bradley Manning. Torture which I'm sure you're all familiar with, where he was put into a solitary cell, isolation, no communication, stripped, etc. And he's going to be saying that pretrial confinement was such a level of abuse and so unlawful and constituted inhuman treatment as well as torture that all charges ought to be dismissed. That hearing will be in October. With regard to Julian Assange, by the time you hear this, will have been in the Ecuadorian embassy for over 50 days. He is awaiting action by the Ecuadorian government on his request for asylum because of his political opinions and because of the persecution by the United States of him because of those political opinions. Ecuador is handling it very carefully, is looking at all kinds of issues around the granting of asylum, and is making its best effort to ensure that if they grant Julian Assange asylum, that he can get himself out of the embassy. My view is that if he is granted asylum, the United Kingdom doesn't really have the right to block him from going to Ecuador, but I'm not sure the United Kingdom agrees with me. So he remains in the embassy. Ecuador has attempted to try and defuse the situation a little bit by going to Sweden, and they sent an envoy to Sweden, as I understand, and they made a request of Sweden. Sounds like a simple request. They said, look it, there's no charges against Julian Assange in Sweden, even though a lot of newspapers, as my aside, say there's charges. There aren't. There's simply allegations, and the Swedish prosecutor wants to question Julian Assange about those allegations. Ecuador is saying to Sweden, There's no charges. If you want to question him about those allegations, why don't you come to the United Kingdom? Why don't you question him at the Ecuadorian embassy? You can do it under oath. You can have a stenographer there. You can do it all. And then if you do that, Julian Assange won't have to be extradited to Sweden, where he's worried because he'll be in jail from the day he arrives in Sweden, that the United States will then get its hands on him. So that was a good offer, it seemed to me, from Ecuador to Sweden, one government to another. But the Swedish response, at least so far, has been no, we're not willing to come to the UK to question Julian Assange. I would ask you, if they're serious about wanting to get to the bottom of what happened with regard to the sexual misconduct allegations in Sweden, wouldn't Sweden go to the UK to find out what happened? But so far, no go. The other thing I think that people are trying to do, or perhaps the Ecuadorian government is trying to do, is get guarantees from the British and the Swedish, but really the British, that if Julian Assange goes to Sweden, he will not be extradited to the United States. Now, you might ask, why does the UK have anything to do with that? He'll be in Sweden. In fact, when a person is extradited from one country to another on a particular allegation, the country that sent the person to the new country has the right to stop the extradition to a third country. In other words, Julian Assange would only be sent to Sweden for certain purposes. Sweden couldn't then extradite him to another country without the consent of the country that sent Julian Assange to Sweden, in this case, the UK. So I think the Ecuadorians will attempt, if they haven't already, to get the British to promise not to give consent for Julian Assange to go to the United States. From what we understand is there may be a decision soon, because we heard that there would not be a decision until after the end of the Olympics, sometime in the middle of August. The other event that took place last week was the visit of Julian Assange's mother, Christine Assange, to Ecuador. She had a meeting with the president. She was given wide publicity. She talked about the fears about her son spending his life in jail or even being subjected to the death penalty in the United States. And she also talked about the pending prosecution that she believes will happen if the United States can get its hands on Julian Assange. It was very, very moving to see her speak on behalf of her son. When you look at the situation with Julian Assange and Bradley Manning, you have to ask yourself, aren't they going after the wrong people? Why are the truth tellers, why are the journalists, the publishers, and the whistleblowers being put at the end of the grand jury, in courts, under criminal indictment, etc.? Why aren't the people who committed the crimes the subject of the grand jury? Well, it's a question we've been asking here at Law and Disorder for a long time. We've been asking at the Center for Constitutional Rights for a long time. It's pretty clear what the right answer is. The torturers, those who have committed war crimes, those who are fighting secret wars, they're the ones that ought to be investigated and not the truth tellers. Well, we'll keep you updated on the cases of Julian Assange and Bradley Manning. And don't forget, if you can get to the trial of Bradley Manning, do it. Almost every month, go to the website of the Bradley Manning Support Committee and find out the dates of the trial and how to get there.
We continue our examination of the Bradley Manning story, the biggest whistleblower case in U.S. history. Joining us in the studio is attorney Chase Madar, author of The Passion of Bradley Manning, the story of the suspect behind the largest security breach in U.S. history. The book moves through Manning's childhood and up to what led him to allegedly upload volumes of classified secret information to WikiLeaks. Madar highlights the value of publicly exposing the endless criminal and immoral actions while government secrecy spins out of control, classifying 92 million documents a year. He also asks what can be done to protect Manning as a whistleblower. Since Manning's arrest 2 years ago, formal court-martial proceedings are not scheduled to begin until February 2013. And as many listeners know, the most serious charge he faces is aiding the enemy. Attorney Chase Madar, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Well, before we get into Bradley Manning's story, I wanted to ask you how you got interested in this, a little bit of your background.
I'm a recovering lawyer. I'm not going to lie. I worked as a staff attorney for several years at a great nonprofit in Bushwick, a section of Brooklyn, doing all kinds of low-tech legal services for Spanish-speaking immigrants and really working in conjunction with political organizers there. But I quit that, and I've been writing about foreign affairs, taking a very different tack for the past few years. I got put on the scent of Bradley Manning by Tom Englehart, who edits the great Tom Dispatch web project. I recommend that everyone sign up for that and get those emails and check it out, tomdispatch.com. But it's a story that resonated with me because so many important issues collide in this case. And whether it is the comparative risk to our security of secrecy versus leaks, how we judge threats, how we misassess threats, how we use solitary confinement as punishment. Is it an exceptional punishment or is it increasingly the general rule? What power does information really have anyway? A lot of us intellectuals like to think that information has this incredible catalytic effect, that all you have to do is get the word out there. What's the cliche? Speak some truth to power and you can change things. It's really not that simple. I think that's overly optimistic, which isn't to say that information is useless either, but it's complicated. But this all comes together in the story of a very, very brave and interesting and mature young man from the small town of Crescent, Oklahoma, named Bradley Manning.
Chase, start with Manning joining the military and bring us up to date to the point where he got arrested.
Okay, so Bradley Manning enlisted in the U.S. Army in October 2007. He's deployed to Iraq after all kinds of training and Army intelligence in October 2009. He allegedly begins leaking things in early 2010, and he is arrested in late May 2010, over 2 years ago now. And he was held in solitary confinement in very strict punitive isolation at Quantico Marine Corps Base in Virginia from July 29, 2010 till April 2011, almost 9 months in pretrial isolation. And that was against the medical advice of the Brig psychiatrist, and that was against the advice of an independent psychiatrist who was called in to examine Manning. He was transferred in large part due to international pressure to Fort Leavenworth, where he's in the medium security population of that military brig in April 2011, and he's been held there for over a year. His court-martial will probably not start till January. So we're looking at 2.5 years of pretrial confinement, and that's very problematic. The first 9 months of that was in very harsh, punitive, and very, very gratuitous solitary confinement. I think solitary confinement is gratuitous just about all the time, but in this case, it was especially nasty.
The material that Bradley Manning leaked has been characterized as just bombshell material. Can you go over some of that with us so our audience gets an idea of the significance of the information that came to light because of Bradley Manning?
You could divide up the WikiLeaks leaks allegedly supplied by Bradley Manning in about three categories. First, you have the Iraq material, and I think the most viral and most sensational document from that is the collateral murder, so-called video. The gunsight video shot from the gunsight of an Apache warship about a mile and a half up in the sky over the Baghdad suburb of New Baghdad from July 2007. And you can see through that gunsight video these Apache helicopters opening fire on a crowd of mostly civilians. A couple of the guys were carrying guns. And that is just a very stark and very shocking look at what this war has been like for many people. No one would say that that's the whole story, but that's a large part of the story, and it's important that we all see that. There are also thousands of war logs. These are SIG Act reports, very raw reports from the field in Iraq filed by soldiers about individual incidents. And you get this great mosaic portrait of a war going terribly in Iraq. You have a similar set of documents for the Afghan war, the Afghan war logs, which are full of tales of night raids gone wrong, of checkpoints gone wrong, and civilians getting killed, of small bases getting built and then abandoned. It's also a composite portrait of a war that is weirdly aimless, unsure of any real mission, and not going very well at all.
When you describe what Bradley Manning leaked with respect to first Iraq and then Afghanistan, it was reminiscent, to my mind, of what Daniel Ellsberg did with the Pentagon Papers. Had you thought of those comparisons?
Absolutely. And in a comparison to Daniel Ellsberg's famous mega leak, the Pentagon Papers, a very instructive way to look at Bradley Manning's alleged leaks, both in the content and in their reception. You see a great deal of difference in how they've been received, because Ellsberg is now seen as a national treasure. The State Department circulates a video worldwide, a documentary about Ellsberg and what a hero he is. But there is not that kind of warm feeling, even among most Democratic Party-oriented intellectuals and media, for Bradley Manning. And even many of the same people who supported Dan Ellsberg back in the day, say Norman Dorson, a former ACLU stalwart, are eager to condemn Bradley Manning. I think there's a real generation gap there. I think it has to do with also the fact that these wars don't have the same sense of urgency, despite their near total failure, for our intellectual class, in large part because there isn't a draft anymore. And with our all-volunteer army, our intellectual class, whether in the media, the law schools, the nonprofits, just doesn't have much skin in the game. And therefore, although they welcomed Ellsberg's leaks, Manning, they are quite happy to marginalize and just dismiss as a malcontent and a weirdo and a saboteur, when he is really nothing of the kind.
Many of us were disappointed because Obama came into office pledging to do more to protect whistleblowers, and yet his administration has gone after more whistleblowers than any other. Why do you think that disconnect?
Well, it's a huge disappointment, what you're saying, that Obama did campaign as the whistleblower's best friend, and he has prosecuted more than twice as many as all previous administrations combined, using the Espionage Act of 1917, which was never intended as an official secrets act to begin with. But there you have it. Why is he doing this? What does he have to gain? Here's one theory that I find very persuasive. It's important to Obama to have the intelligence services on his side. They can cause real headaches for him if they are not more or less compliant. That's happened in the past. That's a common story after World War II with the, I would say, cancerous growth of our national security state. One way for Obama to roll over and show the intelligence services that he's their friend is to throw the book at whistleblowers. He felt like he had to sue them after there was discussion of holding people in CIA accountable, even without criminal prosecutions, about torture. And this was a way of showing the CIA that he was going to, you know, basically go along with them and not give them headaches.
Another difference between Ellsberg and Manning is the development stage of our technology and really the fact that laws governing the internet and sharing of information are new. Do you think that Obama's crackdown has anything to do with the fact that information is so readily available and can reach so many more people on the World Wide Web?
I think that does have something to do with it. Not all that many people actually read the Pentagon Papers when you get down to it. It was high drama, courtroom action. Ellsberg was in hiding for a while. But it's questionable how much impact they actually had. They had the important byproduct of accelerating Nixon's downfall. But how much they actually did to hasten the American withdrawal from Southeast Asia, it's pretty unclear whether they had much impact at all. I don't mean to dismiss Daniel Ellsberg. He says the same thing. And I do want to give him immense credit for an earlier, much lesser known leak that he did in 1968, which of important material about a confidential U.S. Army report and plans for a massive escalation. Leaking that to members of the Senate and to Congress, as he did, probably did have a real effect. So I'm not saying that all leaks are useless. But about, you know, the impact that both the WikiLeaks have had and are going to have, it's still somewhat in question. And I'm pessimistic that they aren't going to be bombshells enough. I would like to see a serious change in our foreign policy, which has gone off the rails. We have not had the kind of course correction with Obama that many of us hoped for. I hope these WikiLeaks things do disrupt foreign policy more to put it on the right track from the path that it's on.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
We're talking with Chase Madar, author of a wonderful book, The Passion of Bradley Manning, the story of the suspect behind the largest security breach in U.S. history.
I'd like to hear something about Bradley Manning, the person. We know so much about him almost as an icon for sharing information and then being persecuted by the government. But what is he like as an individual?
I have not managed to meet Bradley Manning. In fact, neither has anyone else in the media. And it's not because he's held incommunicado. I think he has lawyers' advice not to be too chatty or not to talk at all with the media, because anything he says will certainly be used against him in the court of public opinion, maybe even a court of law, too. So he's being cautious in not letting journalists, even sympathetic writers and journalists, in to see him at Fort Leavenworth. But there has been all kinds of slander and calumny, and smack talked about Bradley Manning. And the assumption is that, well, he's some malcontent. He's a weirdo. He did what he did because he's screwed up. He's crazy. He did it because he's gay. He did it because his family life wasn't ideal. This is all nonsense. His motives for these alleged deeds are very plain to see in the chat logs between Manning and the informant who turned him in. They're the document that is the real rich primary source of what we know about Bradley Manning. And they read like a tragic novella. They're very easy to find on the web, the Manning Lamo, L-A-M-O, chat logs. I recommend them. They read like a tragic novella. But Manning's motive for leaking was that, quote, "I want people to see the truth, regardless of who they are, because without information, you cannot make informed decisions as a public. And he hoped that these would lead, quote, hopefully to worldwide discussions, debates, and reforms. And I fail to see what is so objectionable about this motive, especially after 10 years of disastrous foreign policy, whose failure and catastrophe can be traced in large part to government secrecy, distortion, and, pardon my frankness, but a few fibs as well.
You know, aiding the enemy as a charge is so ironic, Chase, because it seems like the enemy are people like you and Heidi and Jeff and me. The American public is the enemy. We're being aided because we're being told what's going on. It's not like the enemy doesn't know. Of course they know, if you choose to call them the enemy. But in any case, the whole charge is kind of Orwellian.
It's supremely Orwellian. And so much of our secrecy law is designed to keep the American public in the dark. I think we have badly confused being clueless with being safe. And cluelessness does not lead to greater security. It may start out feeling very pleasant, but it inevitably winds up to body bags draped with American flags shipped home, and not to mention hundreds of thousands of foreigners getting killed. And this does not help us.
Although you've not met Manning, what did your research and the writing of this book reveal to you about his childhood or any other characteristics?
Well, he comes across, from everything that's been written about, nearly everything by responsible journalists who have actually looked into it, as an immensely thoughtful and courageous and very principled young man. He grew up in this small town, Crescent, Oklahoma, north central Oklahoma. His father was an IT manager at one of the big rental car agencies. Very bright young man, precociously bright. He won the science fair at his small town school 3 years running. He built his first website at the age of 10 and had mastered C++ programming at a young age. So he's someone who you think would be going directly to one of our top universities for scientific or engineering training. But that's not what happened to him. And just a year and a half after high school, he is living out of his car in Chicago, Oklahoma. And in some ways, he is a quintessential, an extreme version of the millennial generation, who have a lot of education and potential, but find themselves not doing too well. Part of this, in Manning's case, is that I think the adults in his life let him down. And I don't want to badmouth his parents too much. His mother, for various reasons, was just not in a position to take care of her son and give him the support he needed to get beyond. He was taking care of his mother, in fact, from a very young age, taking care of writing the checks to local utilities from about the age of 10. And his father and mother split up when Manning was about 15. And father, from all the accounts of people who've gone to Crescent, talked to people, not a great guy. And Manning, after finishing high school, he didn't have the financial support either from home or from the state to make it to university, even the public university in Oklahoma. So he does what a lot of people do who really want to go to college but don't have the means, and that's enlist in the military. And this wasn't a completely crazy thing for Manning to do, even if it is 2007 and the war has clearly gone disastrously in Iraq, and the war in Afghanistan is forgotten but not going particularly well either. His father was in naval intelligence, and Manning had grown up with this sense of patriotic responsibility, something he took very seriously, not in a jingoistic, nationalistic way, but he really believed in patriotic duty. And he really thought that Operation Iraqi Freedom might have at least something to do with Iraqi freedom. And he doesn't have a great time when he gets in the military. He's 5'2". He's gay. Okay, you wonder why. They said he was almost discharged, but in the end, in 2007, recruitment levels that are at record lows, they need people with Bradley Manning's IT skills. He's a computer whiz. They need him. So when Manning is in basic training, he almost gets discharged from the army. He's getting picked on horribly, but he's still a true believer in the mission, and he really wants to see this through. So he does, after a couple years being trained at various bases around the country, get deployed to Iraq, to a small base that was built as part of the Surge Forward Operating Base Hammer, and he is deployed to the SCIF, which is an acronym for the where all the secured computers are, and he's in Army Intelligence, and it's a pretty miserable existence. I've talked to a few people who are on that base at the same time as Manning. People are doing 14-hour shifts, 6-7 days a week. You don't see much of the country. You go out and look out into the desert. There's nothing that you can see but desert, a little scrub, not a village in sight, not even a hut in sight. And it's an immensely tedious existence there. So what is Manning doing when he's in Iraq? What really makes him turn on the inside and allegedly leak these things? Well, the main thing is that he is asked to look into the arrest and capture by the Iraqi authorities of a group of nonviolent Iraqi civilian protesters who were handing out pamphlets that were all about corruption in the Iraqi government. Where does the money go is the name of this pamphlet. And Manning is profoundly concerned about this because he knows, because the Army is keeping close records on this, that the habit and practice of torture by the Iraqi authorities did not end with the American invasion. In fact, it's still going on full force in the midst of this insurgency and sectarian warfare there. So Bradley Manning is wondering, what are Americans doing here, invading a country, occupying it just to sit by, take notes while people are getting tortured? People who may have just written a pamphlet about financial corruption in an immensely corrupt government. That really changed his mind. And when he brought his concerns up the chain of command, he was told to shut up and help the Iraqis round up more prisoners. And something, according to Manning himself, in these chat logs with the informant to Trinidad, really snapped then. And that's when he reached out to WikiLeaks.
Tell us about the classified documents, the number of documents that are classified. One could say overclassification. And what does that mean?
We have a huge problem with overclassification in this country. Currently, Washington classifies 92 million documents a year, according to the Information Security Oversight Office. And that's up from 77 million the year before. It's an extreme problem. What Bradley Manning is alleged to have leaked, by the way, the classified material doesn't even amount to 1% of what Washington classifies in any given year. And it's important to keep a sense of that scale and perspective, because so much of the reaction to WikiLeaks, even among nice centrists and liberals, has been this, I have to say, hysterical response that we're somehow on a slippery slope towards total transparency. And the next thing you know, we're going to have nuclear launch codes floating around. That is very far from the case. Again, what WikiLeaks is alleged to have, what they've released, is not even 1% of what Washington classifies in any given year. We are light years away from total transparency. What WikiLeaks has done is just shine a very thin, focused flashlight in immense darkness. Declassification, on the other hand, moves in geological time. It's only last year that the National Security Agency finished declassifying documents from the War of 1812, a two-century lag in declassification. So pundits who complain about too much transparency are simply not acquainted with the bare facts or the goalposts that we have here.
You've been following the Manning case for a long time, and as I recall, you're a part of our Center for Constitutional Rights lawsuit around the documents in the case. Is that right?
That's right. I'm proud to be a plaintiff on that with some other great people.
So tell us why you joined that case, and if you know better than I do, this is Michael Ratner speaking, what's going on?
Well, nothing conclusive yet. The courts have rejected. You're the fine lawyers at CCR. Shane Cadidal, I think, is the lead attorney there, keeps appealing it. And the main thing is to make records of the court proceedings publicly available. That's one of the main goals of this suit. And we're hoping that people can at least see what's going on here. I think, I hate to be a spoiler, I think that a guilty conviction with a heavy sentence of at least 50 years is a foregone conclusion in this. And I'm not going to peddle false optimism. I think it's a long-term battle to get Bradley Manning out of the clink, to get him the real justice he deserves. And that battle is contiguous with the battle for more transparency in this country. And you see, even in the court proceedings, how this mania for secrecy has corrupted the court martial.
It's remarkable, actually, because the documents you're talking about trying to get access through with the CCR lawsuit are public documents. These are not secret documents. These are the motions that are made by the government, the motions by the defense, at least he's getting to put some of those up, the court decisions, not secret. And yet there's no access to those documents. I mean, I find it just remarkable. It's really ironic.
It's very emblematic of the overclassification and the mania for secrecy that we suffer from. And I'd like to repeat, this does not make us safer. If you look at the Iraq War, a war that was a total disaster, killed at a very cautious estimate a minimum of 100,000 Iraqi civilians plus 4,500 U.S. soldiers. This was caused in large part by excessive government secrecy, distortion, and lies. These are the wages of government secrecy, not security, but disaster.
Can you catch us up to where the trial is right now? And when do you expect the real trial?
We're in the midst of pretrial hearings. The court-martial keeps getting postponed. We're over 2 years of pretrial confinement right now. It looks like the court-martial won't begin until January or February.
Do you have any recommendations for the general public who may be outraged at the crackdown on whistleblowers and, of course, Bradley Manning in specific?
One nice thing that everyone can do is send a postcard or a little note to Bradley Manning. Go to the Bradley Manning Support Network website. You can Google that easily. And the Bradley Manning Support Network website, and get Manning's address at Fort Meade, where he's being tried, or at Fort Leavenworth. I think there are a number of small groups, political groups I've talked to, that are energized by these leaks. I've talked to some Haitian American activists who are active at the grassroots level in Florida and New York, and they are thrilled by what the leaks have done for politicized Haitians, because there's a lot of distortion, lies, and paranoia, unreliable news. But The Nation magazine did a great series of reports on the Haiti leaks about a year ago, and you can look at that. I think it's your patriotic duty just to browse the leaks. If you're Italian American, look at the leaks about Italy. They're fascinating. You know, these aren't bombshells a lot of the time, but you get a very candid assessment of what Sicily is like today. What does the government think about it? There's a minor masterpiece of travel writing by the U.S. consul to Russia, going to a wedding in the Caucasus Mountains. It's vivid. It's great. There's a great report, a digest of the Mexico leaks up in The Nation right now. This is added to our knowledge of foreign policy. Why is that such a bad thing? This doesn't hurt us. This does not put us at risk. It hasn't put anyone else at risk either, despite the panicky Armageddon mongering scenarios that our government officials have spouted with each new wave of leaks. But when asked by journalists a week or two after these freakouts, the government officials quietly retract this. There's no evidence whatsoever that any civilian or soldier has been harmed by these leaks. Instead, we have a great increase in our knowledge, and that's a good thing.
There's an irony in the fact that as we discuss WikiLeaks and the sort of shadow of government secrecy, that our government, as well as corporations, are more than ever spying on individual Americans through every business transaction that we conduct, every telephone call, smart text. so that on the one hand, they're claiming secrecy, but they have privy to every single motion that we make.
Exactly. That is, of course, the opposite of how things should be. The more power an institution has, the more transparent it should be required to be. The less power an individual has, the more privacy they should be allowed, or they should have. And you know, the idea that government should be as transparent as possible, this was not invented by Julian Assange last year. It's a very old idea in the American political tradition. It was James Madison, by the way, who said that a popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy, or perhaps both. And it was Woodrow Wilson, the first of his 14 points, who wrote that open covenants of peace, openly arrived at, after which there shall be no private international understanding of any kind, but diplomacy shall proceed always frankly and in the public view. Frankly and in the public view. And these ideas of transparency, of public oversight, they're not a central part of our political tradition because they're noble ideals or high-minded. They're an important part of our political tradition because these ideas work. When you don't have a high degree of transparency, when you don't have well-informed decisions, you get disaster. You get the invasion of South Vietnam. You get the invasion of Iraq. These are the wages of government secrecy.
Chase, in addition to the work you've been doing on Bradley Manning and your fine book on Manning, I know maybe for the first time that you're a lawyer, which I didn't know, but I read a fascinating article by you. What was the name of it? It's on international law.
It's called Legal Atrocities, and Tom Dispatch has it out. Legal Atrocities.
And it's quite interesting because it brings up, as I recall, the collateral video murder tape that was allegedly released by Bradley Manning, put on the web by WikiLeaks. That's the killing of the two Reuters journalists and then the shooting at some children. Well, why don't you give us what your argument is about international law and what's prohibited and what's not prohibited under the laws of war? We won't have a lot of time to discuss it, but I want to get our listeners to understand some of the discussion about international law.
Well, first, Michael, thank you for outing me as an attorney. I really appreciate that. We lawyers and even people who are not lawyers, God bless them, often have this bizarre faith in international law, especially people, I'd say, in the center left around the world. This idea that international law is this wonderful, humane thing all the time, that it's the solution to our problems. Well, sometimes it may be. But very often we forget that international law is just written by the lawyers of immensely powerful imperial states. And if you look at the collateral murder video, this horrific video of the Apache gunship gunning down a crowd of mostly civilians, it's quite shocking to learn that act of warfare was probably perfectly legal according to the laws of armed conflict. Now, I say that not to excuse it or apologize for it or say it was a good thing. Not at all. It's plainly an atrocity. But just because something's an atrocity doesn't mean that it violates the laws of armed conflict. This isn't just my marginal opinion, but Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Human Rights First were all stone cold silent after this video was released and did not issue any statement about it, even though commenting on international humanitarian law violations, those are laws of war violations, are their bread and butter. And I talked to lawyers at all three of those organizations, and they admitted that, yeah, the law is kind of muddy on that killing because there were a couple armed guys in that crowd of civilians, so it was probably legal. Even when the unmarked van drives by to pick up the wounded and the helicopter opens fire on that and kills the driver, wounds the children, that was legal too because it's not marked with a Red Cross or a Red Crescent. So it's shocking to learn that atrocities can be perfectly legal. And this forces the question, well, what is the point of the laws of war? Is it really to restrain violence, or is it to authorize lethal violence? Most of the time, the purpose of the laws of armed conflict, it's a lube for violence. It licenses it, and it's all about giving permission for it. That's not at all what we like to think frequently that international law is all about.
Well, I think that's a really important point. And we'll be back to discussing that on our show some more, because obviously what I do is, you know, we do at the center is look at law and international law, and particularly illegality of war, illegality of atrocities, et cetera. And of course, what we run into is very, very academic, almost scholastic arguments about the legality of drones, the legality of Guantanamo, the legality of the abuse at Guantanamo, from lots of lawyers who can, you know, stand angels on the head of a pin when it comes to talking about international law. So the center's against when we do this is very strong arguments made by people who say, well, that's not beyond the law. And so then we obviously, it's not that we retreat. It's just that, I mean, we can argue the other way. But in the end, no matter what you say, the use of drones, the use of Guantanamo, in my view, it's not acceptable morally, politically, or legally. But it is true. Once you get into the legal argument, because the laws of war are made by the big powers, they're very, very difficult to undercut.
That's a critical point. I think it's been too often forgotten that war is not a matter of law at the end. And just because something might be legal doesn't mean that it's advisable, prudent, going to have good consequences. Every day we are all faced with possibilities of actions that are perfectly legal that would be immensely stupid and destructive.
Attorney Chase Madar, author of The Passion of Bradley Manning, the story of the suspect behind the largest security breach in U.S. history. It's been a pleasure to have you with us.
Great talking with all of you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks.
Right. Really appreciate it. If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Thank you.